Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
There is a book out called Off the Charts, and it is about child prodigies. It's just fascinating, the stories in this book. And for those of you that think your kid is gifted and talented and might be a prodigy, I almost hope for you that they are not. Ann Hulbert wrote this book. And she joins us now on WGN. Ann, I'm John Williams. Welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you so much for inviting me.
I hope you don't mind coming on a show that is this free with the facts right now. Numbers are just flying left and right, and we're not sure of all of them.
That is totally fine with me.
What got you? Were you a child prodigy yourself? What inspired you to look into this for a book?
No, I was not a child prodigy. I wrote another book, which was about a cultural history of child-rearing experts, and said lots of things about how we could raise our children so they would be better and better and more fulfilled in their potential. And I finished that book and sort of realized I'd written lots about grown-ups and lots about theory, but I hadn't really written that much about children and what amazing children can actually do. So I thought, we're living in a society in which we all kind of want to have proto-prodigies. It would be really interesting to go back and look at what particular children who'd stirred up interesting conversations and debates had actually done and what their lives were like.
But we're talking about a different class of kid entirely here. I mean, so my kid got A's in school and somebody else's kid was in the gifted program at the local high school, but we're talking about kids that are, well, as your book says, off the charts. What are we talking about here when we talk about the young people that you wrote about?
Well, the ones I've written about vary a lot, and I've chosen them for sort of reasons that both relate to how great they are at what they do, from chess to music to computers to actually writing fiction as children.
Yeah, poetry,
Poetry, and had a novel published at 12, one of the girls I read about in the 1920s. But I'm also, I chose them partly because the realms in which they were particularly outstanding made people very interested in the times they were excelling. So these literary girls, for example, a poet I write about named Natalia Crane and a novelist named Barbara Follett, were busy doing their writing in the 20s when, in a sort of war-weary, jaded time, the idea that children had imaginations that were completely fresh and wonderful in ways that adults really couldn't match was enthralling to adults. And so there was a lot of attention paid to the what kids could do. And you don't usually think of child prodigies being in the realms of literature, but at that point, partly because of adult interest, these girls got a lot of attention, and lots of other girls started writing, and there was a sort of what was called an epidemic of creativity. So,
well, would you say that these prodigies, because you're right, you write about musicians, you write about Bobby Fischer. I'm so glad my eighth grade term paper was about Bobby Fischer. I didn't write a book about it, though. But he always struck me as a brilliant, gifted, and tragic character. And I think that's one thing that is true about a lot of the young people you write about, is that I don't know that they were all happy, and I don't know that those were all happy households. But would you say that if I aspired for my kid to be an outlier, you know, to be something off the charts, is that something that I can instill in him, or are these kids just born with these traits?
Well, that is a subject on which their parents and promoters would disagree. The first story I write about were two boys who got to Harvard before they were teenagers, and their fathers, who were Russian immigrants, proclaimed that anybody could turn their children into a Norbert Wiener, that was one of the boys, or a William James Sidis. Their view was, it's all in the brilliant teaching of the parents and in catching the children early, these pliable brains. At the same time, Henry Cowell, who grew up to be a great American musician, was growing up on the West Coast, and he had parents who believed that it was all completely innate, and his great musical genius was his alone, and he attracted the attention of a psychologist, Lewis Terman, who took that view, too. He was very much a hereditarian. So you will find in the different stories quite different views on this subject.
Well, I want to be delicate about this, but would you say that those kids who can do complex mathematical equations or understand physics at the age of four or invent a language or lecture at Harvard about the fourth dimension or write sophisticated, almost sensual poetry, you know, when they're single digits aged, would you say that those are people who are so different that it's almost diagnosable? It's almost like autism or Asperger's. These are people who, while we see their talents as a manifestation, it's a manifestation of something maybe wrong with them. I don't know that I put that nicely.
That's a very interesting question. And I think I came away from my cast of characters thinking that in some way, of course, simply being an outlier does mean you are in some way not normal. I would say, though, that in the case of some of the kids I write about, and in particular, I think, both of the literary girls, I actually think a large part of their exceptional nature was the product, not of express nurture. No one was trying to turn them into a poet or a novelist, but they had such conducive settings and adults around who were very interested in encouraging their talents that they ended up off the charts. I think, though, if they had gone to, at least if Barbara had gone to school, she was homeschooled in the end, I think she would have made a lot of friends and been a child who we might well not have said to ourselves, yeah, we need to diagnose her.
Was Bill Gates off the charts?
He was, as a child, you know, a real handful at school, a handful for his teachers, a handful for his parents, but he also had his core of friends, who were all in their own way kind of outliers together, which I think made a big difference. I think peer group associations do make a big difference for a child, not necessarily in making them conventional, but in giving them some of the sort of normalcy of a childhood that isn't a real loner outlier childhood.
Bill Gates is almost the outlier among outliers, right? Because some of these people don't have a practical application for their intelligence, and obviously Gates has. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, it's true. I mean, one of the interesting things I think about the computer moment and those prodigies is that, unlike most of the prodigies I write about before, these math and chess and literary prodigies, these kids were actually doing something that adults really didn't know much about. They were literally themselves leading the way and figuring out what the practical applications of this would be. They were not sort of matching adult prowess, which is what we usually think of when we think of prodigies, as they're doing something as kids that an adult can do. These kids were doing things that adults didn't know how to do. And I do think that's a big distinction.
I think it's also interesting, the timing of it. You know, if Bill Gates were born 50 years earlier, 100 years earlier, or maybe even 20 years earlier, his genius would not have found at least that place to go.
I think that's absolutely right. One of the things I came away from the work on this book thinking is how important sort of cultural moments are. I think the same thing is true. Maybe you will disagree about Bobby Fischer. You know, he got interested in chess at a moment when chess was really important, yeah, in a sort of global way that intensified his interest, that got other adults who in the chess world really interested in him. That meant that, you know, all kinds of issues that might have given people pause about Bobby Fischer didn't, because he seemed like such a great asset. So I do think cultural moments and historical sort of turning points play a big role in selecting out talent and what we recognize as talent.
We forget today what a big deal that was in 1972 when Bobby Fischer and Boris Spassky meet in Reykjavik, Iceland, and the conditions under which they would play and who would be in the room and would there be cameras and what the temperature would be and how many matches would be played and what they're playing chess. What could be more basic than that? But it was years in the planning, and finally they get them to play this chess match, and it was of such cultural consequence, as you point out. I mean, I don't know that I knew or remembered much of this, but you sure make it interesting, a chess match decades and decades later. But that was us versus the Soviet Union, Jack. That was a very tense moment. We were all looking for some sort of symbolism. So we were rooting for Bobby, and they were rooting for Boris. And Henry Kissinger is on the phone line with Bobby Fischer before the match starts, saying, "Now listen, whatever you do, don't like start World War XII, okay?" It was bizarre.
Well, and I think what was sort of interesting is to see how the contrast between the sort of American way of chess and the Soviet way of chess kicked in even earlier when Bobby was learning. You know, he was patching together a kind of improvisatory way of learning chess in a country that, you know, didn't really have much of a chess establishment at that point at all, versus Boris Spassky in Russia. You know, he went to the youth pavilions. He had a very clear-cut path with all kinds of national support, and it was extremely streamlined. And I think it made Americans kind of proud to think that they had this maverick boy who was forging his own way that was really democratic and individualist, and then
an American
he was supposed to be.
So hold on one second. Ann Hilbert's on a phone line. Her book is off the charts, and this is the best question of all. Mark on line one says, so do prodigies top out early or do they keep developing? And answer that in a minute on WGN. We're wrapping up a conversation with Ann Hulbert. Her book is off the charts. She is the literary editor at The Atlantic. Her book is about these child prodigies. And one of our listeners has a question. Let's go ahead and put Mark on, too. Hey, Mark, you're on WGN. What was your question?
Yeah, is there a misconception or a stereotype about prodigies where they accomplish everything they can real early and then they just have to repackage their successes in new forms and essentially repeat them and be bored? Or does a prodigy create brand new frontiers and, you know, expand beyond what we've ever seen before all his life?
That is a really good question, and the answer is there prodigies do different things, but every prodigy does have a kind of crisis of purpose and direction in adolescence, where I think some of the answers to your questions come. Suddenly, what has been a kind of automatic and more early mastery of a skill then has to become a kind of self-aware, actual direction for the future in which critical and, you know, purposeful direction becomes much more important. Some prodigies find their way through that sort of, it's called a midlife crisis, because for them it really is almost the middle of their lives, come through it renewed. And Norbert Wiener, the founder of cybernetics, went on to become, you know, a very creative man throughout his life and was not repackaging things. Shirley Temple, of course, ended up having to leave. Different paths are.
I'm glad you mentioned that. Shirley Temple's a great part of your story. Her vocabulary, her personality, her dance skills. she was a prodigy, I guess, in that sense, huh?
Well, she was she would have been the first to say that she was not probably the best dancer or the best singer there had ever been, but she was this amazingly confident and sort of self-directed creature of a studio system that would have probably crushed anyone who wasn't as kind of self-directed and indomitable as she. She was a great learner, but she also really knew how to work with people, which in that line of work was absolutely crucial. And she also was someone who went on to not become a, you know, ever more creative movie star, but went on to become a diplomat. I suppose that's a different way that a prodigy's path can go. You can leave the field you were in and have a life of a very different sort on another trajectory. Well, he did that.
And it's fascinating because in the book you point out that Shirley Temple, as an actor, as a young lady, was always sort of accommodating or repairing things in her family. Her parents bled her finances dry, and she managed that. She managed the studio. She managed her life and career. Then what did you do with that extraordinary talent, if you will? Well, you become a diplomat. You become an ambassador to countries some people don't want to be ambassadors to. So there was a certain symmetry to her story there. The book is off the charts. And Hulbert, I'm out of time. It's fascinating to meet you. Thanks for doing the work and keep doing what you do. It's well done.
Thanks so much for having me on.